How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio, Monday, October 11th, 2010, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Last night was Raw from Seattle. I was there in attendance. I had a good time. I thought it was a good show. I have no idea how it came across on TV. I haven't watched it yet. I heard there were some Michael Cole-isms that he came off as probably worse than me in terms of memory, because he actually thought that Team Nexus lost. Or won at SummerSlam, I think is what he said.
They won at SummerSlam. Like, he was screaming about how John Cena picking Daniel Bryan on that team. You know, look what good it did. Then we went and lost the match.
Yeah.
That was really the only one. I was just surprised that, you know, he screamed it, and then I guess they didn't want to embarrass him. You know, and it would have been an embarrassment to correct it. But still, it was the main event at SummerSlam, and he was broadcasting the match. So
yeah, it was a big one.
You know, but, you know, he let's face it. He's doing so much broadcasting, you know, it's real easy for him to get confused. I mean, they've done rematches, you know, that Nexus won, and they did, so.
I get confused all the time watching all these shows.
Yeah, well, it's when you're doing the same matches over and over and over again, you know, it's kind of hard to remember who won what, which time. You know, it's not like before when, you know, you would build to big matches and the big matches meant something. I mean, that's one of the things that we talked about last week with the pay-per-views. It used to be you build to the big matches. You know, now the pay-per-view is just something, you know, in between Raws, and, you know, they'll do rematches on Raw anyway. And, you know, I mean, like, look at like, the thing last night, just as an example, for Bound for Glory, it's supposed to be the big climactic show. So Tara wins the women's title, and then the very next day on TV, Madison Rayne gets it. It's like, why didn't you just win the first night and make the pay-per-view, mean something? If you bought the pay-per-view and then you see that on TV, it's kind of like, well, I mean, it's the women's title. It really doesn't matter, in a sense. But the flip side of it is that when you, you're making sure that it's never going to matter, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's TNA, I mean, we'll talk about this later. TNA is doing a lot of things, and almost all of them are copies of things before, which is okay, because almost everything in wrestling has been done before and is being copied. But TNA, like, copies all the things that failed. And then, you know, they fail. They usually, more often than not, they fail again. And it just boggles my mind, because it's, like, run by people who were failures, and here it is 10 years later, and always had the excuse of why they were failures, okay? And, you know, didn't learn from their mistake. I mean, really didn't learn from their mistakes. And, you know, but whatever. I mean, Dixie put him in charge. And
I hate to use the term broken record, but it's been 8 years now. And, you know, I mean, how many times have we talked about these exact same things? You'd think that at some point, I don't know, maybe you wouldn't.
It's the craziest thing, because, like, just an example is, like, Nash. You know, and, you know, of all people, like, you know, Nash, who was, you know, one of the worst bookers of all time in that 99 run, you know, he would sit there when you know, months ago, and he would go to Jeff and goes, like, Jeff, you were here. None of, you know, this was all the stuff that put us out of business. Why are we doing it again? You know, and you would think, like, Jeff, it's Jeff's the, you know, a real confusing one to me, because Jeff, you know, grew up the son of a booker, in a territory that, you know, basically had to live and die by success and failure. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when you're doing a weekly territory and you're making money depends on what you draw, you know, largely on Monday night off of a Saturday television show, you learn in a hurry what works and what doesn't work. Now he wasn't the booker, his dad was, and he grew up watching it.
Well, and I'm gonna say this. This is kind of, it's a little bit different, but I used to go to Buddy Wayne's wrestling school all the time, and guys would show up to start training, and these were guys that had watched professional wrestling for years and years and years, and they were huge fans, and you'd see them training, and sometimes they would be so completely clueless to, like, the most basic things that you would sit there and go, did you ever actually watch wrestling when you were watching wrestling? And I think that sometimes you can be the son of a great booker, or you can grow up watching wrestling that was booked in a really, really,
but not just grow up. I mean, he worked it.
Yeah, but that's to me, it's just like...
I mean, Brian, remember that angle that you were all raving about when you watched that Lance Russell television show?
Yeah.
I mean, Jeff was in that angle.
Well, Jeff, clearly, there are people that can be around, surrounded by this kind of thing and not have a clue. I mean, just look at it this way. Here's a perfect example. Triple H was like the biggest fan of Ric Flair in the world. He traveled with Ric Flair. Is there anybody who has had, like, a more... I don't know. You would just think that the Triple H would have had more of a clue than he does in terms of a lot of the ways that he presented himself and I don't know.
But you know what? I will say this, because with Triple H, I always felt that Triple H protected himself so much more than Ric Flair. So it could have been that he learned from Ric Flair. And, you know, remember, everything that they did with Ric Flair didn't work either. And probably thought, you know, the problem with Rick, I mean, Rick's a great worker, you know, and you know, one of the great workers of all time. But, you know, when Rick didn't protect himself and would put people over and over again, Triple H, he may have gotten that thing like, you know, wait a minute. You know, I don't want to be like Ric Flair having these great matches but not drawing because I give so much up. So I got to, you know, make myself a star and make sure I protect my stardom by only losing when it's the right time to lose as opposed to losing all the time. And, you know, maybe in his mind, the right time to lose was very infrequently. So, I mean, I can see where Triple H comes from because I sort of, I mean, you know, it's not like I agree with all of his stuff, but I understand, like, what when he was on top, you know, his mentality. You know, I always did. You know, and the way he worked, you know, I was never, you know, I just remember, you know, like in the old days of Triple H, not so much now, but in the old days of Triple H, the way he would lay out a match, I never saw a wrestler who would, you know, I mean, I could close my eyes and almost do move for move everything Triple H would do because I just, like, understood what he was doing because it was the stuff that, you know, he grew up watching and the stuff I grew up watching. And technical layout of matches and, you know, positioning and stuff, he was great, you know, but, you know, I don't think his promos were hit and miss, you know, but that's a different issue. But the point is, I do understand Triple H, even though at times, you know, I think that his standard of what a guy needs to do to be on top was so high, perhaps because, you know, again, admiring Ric Flair, well, you know, this is what a top guy is, and all of these guys that wanted to come up, you know, and that they wanted to give world titles to and that he would nix and things like that. In his mind, you know, it's just like, well, this is the standard of a world champion, Ric Flair or Shawn Michaels, and these guys aren't at that level, and they weren't, and maybe that was, you know, where he came from. You know, and the idea, you know, of protecting the world championship and stuff, you know, now, which they don't do. So, so I understand that. It's just weird watching, you know, again, it's not that they repeat stuff, you know, like the NWO angle, you know, being repeated, because, you know...
That is something, though.
It's like, you know, Russo and Eric, you know, have their, like, things that they always repeat over and over again, so this is just the latest repeat of it, but at least, like, this was, like, a famous angle that worked when it did work. I mean, it worked really well when it first worked.
In 1996.
But... they replayed, you know, today they did the lay down and do the title thing, and they did that, I think, three times in WCW, and all three times it failed. Now, it's not going to kill them because, again, it was the women's title tonight with Tara laying down for Madison Rayne and Madison Rayne becoming the champion. So, but the theory behind it is, it's like, you took something that you did three times, it failed three times, you're still going to do it because it's like you don't know the difference between your successes and your failures, and you blame all your failures on, you know, big bad management. It's like, fuck. The wrestling fans watching had no idea about big bad management. They stopped watching or they stopped buying because you produced angles that they shit on, you know? And it's the same thing with TNA now. It's like, you know, the pay-per-view numbers are down, you know, are terrible, you know? And, you know, the house shows are stuck at the same level they've been stuck at for years. And you go in there with your, you know, all of your excuses about the economy or, you know, that people won't buy pay-per-views anymore, which, you know, is the greatest of all time. You know, I mean, Dixie's thing, well, you know, people don't buy pay-per-views anymore. It's like, no, it's not. That's not the case. you know, but whatever.
Even the NWO angle. I mean, Hulk Hogan was not the most popular babyface on the roster when he turned.
No, he wasn't.
He was starting to get a serious backlash.
Well, he had a serious backlash for a long time, but it got real bad at certain points. I mean, a lot of people go, "Oh, it was only in certain cities." They did a lot of stuff with the audio, and it wasn't, you know. And a lot of the house shows, he didn't work that many house shows. I should say that, but when there were certain house shows where he got booed and stuff when he did work, but he, you know, it was hit and miss. There were places he was still getting cheered, and there were places he was getting booed out of the building. But you're right. What you're saying is correct. He wasn't universally loved, and there were many, many people who were sick of him. And there was a point where it got real bad. You know, where, you know, I mean, I remember thinking that, you know, he's done. He can't be. The people will not cheer him anymore. And you know, business. You know, he wasn't meaning anything for business anymore, and he was getting tons of money. So they did the heel turn, and you know, it worked for a couple of years, but. I mean, as far as Jeff Hardy goes, I do have to say this. Okay, Jeff Hardy was the only difference maker in the company. And, again, we'll have to wait and see what happens at the house shows. But there is something, you know, and that was just last week they had the Carolinas run. And they did not, you know, this is his home territory. And him and Ric Flair were on the shows. And they did 700, 853, and one was so bad that I couldn't even get the number. And then there was one that was about, you know, maybe 1,000 or 1,100, whatever. But the point is that Jeff making a difference was wearing out, and he was starting to not make a difference. Now, he's still the most over guy. Everyone screams for him. But was he drawing extra numbers? It was starting not to happen. So I don't know that they're risking anything. I also wonder when they go to those house shows if the people aren't all going to cheer for Jeff anyway. But, you know, maybe he'll go out there and turn the people like Flair did, you know, because Bill Goldberg and Sting, when they failed as heels and they had to turn them back, it was because they were so mentally against it, and you could see that, you know what I mean, it wasn't working. At the same time, we can go back to the Austin thing, you know, in 2001, and Austin was 100% behind that heel turn, and it was still a disaster because it was the wrong thing for business. And, you know,
well, my guess is
a Jeff Hardy heel turn probably, you know, they probably should have been someone else, honestly. I think a Jeff Hardy heel turn probably was a bad idea.
To me, realistically, I don't know if there's anything that's really the wrong move for TNA business, because it's not like anything is really affecting business one way or the other right now. You've got a core group of people that are going to watch no matter how good or horrible the television is. You probably have a core group of people that are going to buy the pay-per-views. Core group of people that are going to go to the house shows, and Jeff Hardy turning heel. I mean, a lot of people were really down on this yesterday, but to me it was just like, let's see what happens. And number two,
you have to wait and see what happens. Yeah, but there is a thing. Again, if Jeff Hardy was bringing extra people in, like Steve Austin did, okay, and then you turn him, I mean, we've seen the Steve Austin example, those extra people don't come anymore, or they quit watching television. It happened. This is not some...
Sure,
This is not some theory. This is a proven fact.
Yeah, but there's not that risk in TNA right now.
No. If Jeff was starting to really cool down the last couple of, you know, the last month or so as a draw, and you know, I think that as time went on, he was going to draw less and less because the Jeff Hardy that was drawing was the WWE Jeff Hardy that everyone remembered from last year, who was super hot. And as time goes on, you know, the guy from WWE becomes, you know, less and less. Because he's in TNA, so
he actually lasted a hell of a lot. He lasted a hell of a lot longer than most of the guys that come from WWE in terms of drawing.
At the arenas, absolutely. Which is funny because as TV ratings, Jeff never drew once. I mean, even for week one, week one because that first week he did draw a good rating. But remember when Jeff and RVD were working at the, you know, I mean, I just remember those 0.73 quarters with Jeff Hardy and RVD. You know, very early on in the run, going like, "How is this possible?" Jeff was the most over guy, and you know, and he wasn't drawing any TV ratings, and he still, you know, like, I mean, when you look at the quarters, I mean, Jeff's never been a quarter mover, you know, to this day. So, yeah, you know, it's just a change. It shuffles things. I mean, it's good. They needed to make a change and shuffle things up. I think it's going to help a little bit, but in the long run, I think that all of the problems that were there before are still going to be there, and they're inability to make stars and their inability to develop talent and their inability to plan anything long term and book long term. And basically they're going to be, they're where they are, and they're probably going to stay where they are. And this regime is not going to be the regime that changes it. And I don't know if there is a regime out there that would do it, but this one isn't it.
Let's talk about Raw. A couple of notes from the live show. I'm not the best in the world at estimating attendance, but I'd say probably between 9 and 10,000 people were there.
That's a good number.
It was a pretty good number. I would say that three quarters of the very upper deck were curtained off. And then obviously they only used about, three quarters of the arena. There was a large area that was taken up by the Titantron in the backstage area. But I mean, other than that, the place was pretty much full. A couple empty seats over by the hard camera side, but it was a pretty healthy crowd. And I think I mentioned this last time there was a WWE show in Seattle, but I was really surprised by the lack of kids. And I'm not saying that there were no kids there, because obviously there were some kids there, but I mean, the idea that, I mean, people have this idea nowadays of kids just swarming these buildings and that sort of thing, and really,
at the house shows, that's the case. It's not the case at TVs.
No.
The deal is that pay-per-views, you get the real hardcore audience, because they buy tickets first. And then the TVs, the SmackDowns, you're going to get more kids, because the adults don't see SmackDown as that big of a deal. And then the Raws, you usually will have a little less kids, or a lot less kids than the your house shows. When I go to the house shows, it's kid laden, but that's also because the number is so small, the people there, and the adults know not to go, and the kids just want to see their wrestling. And I think the Raw, adults will go to Raw because it means something. Even though, in the funniest thing is that in many cases, I probably am more entertained generally at a house show, because the guys are out there, kind of giving you matches and stuff. Whereas a TV, it's rushed and it's so structured, and you.
Well, not this TV. This was a good TV.
There was a really good match with Sheamus and Daniel Bryan, and then of course the next storyline was played for week two.
I noticed that in Todd's report here, I'm going to go a lot by his report since I don't have one typed out here, but he was talking about how at the beginning of this show, you could see there were a lot of pro-Nexus signs, and he wrote, presumably to support Cena. And I don't know if I agree with that, because there were a lot of Nexus fans, and these people were into Nexus coming out and not John Cena coming out. And there were a lot of Daniel Bryan chants on the show, obviously, because he was local. But one of the things without the large kid contingent is you could tell there were points where the kids that were there were trying to chant for John Cena, but they weren't there in mass numbers, and so they were easily booed, just shot down by the rest of these fans. But there were heel fans in this building, and they were into Nexus, and especially, I guess it came off really well on TV, but the final segment with Cena and Wade Barrett, I mean, everybody was on their feet watching this segment, and they were really into this segment. It really felt like this is a hot angle, and if they don't screw this up, this is going to do one of the better buy rates of the year when these two guys finally end up having a match. Now,
I should hope that they won't screw. But the thing is like, what is their track record of having something like this?
That's my concern.
By the time they get to the match,
yeah.
Because you got to remember, realistically, I would think you wouldn't even want the match till either TLC or Royal Rumble. I don't think you can hold it till Mania. And who knows? Maybe they will, but I don't.
If they knew what they were doing, they could hold it till Mania.
Yeah, if they're not going to, I don't think.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean,
I have so little faith that I actually thought that they might have something happen on this show. I mean, it was just
You mean like hit him? God,
yeah.
I was just rooting for him not to touch him.
So was I.
If he hit him, it would have been, like, horrible.
Yeah.
Because it's like it's way, way, way too early. And, I mean, what was great about it is all that heat is people really want to see him punch that guy. And he, Wade Barrett did a great job in that final segment. I mean, that was, and Cena did too,
They were both outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, both of them. I mean, because you really got it, you know, you could really see, you really wanted him to hit him, and you just wanted it so bad, and Cena acted like he wanted it so bad, and then he walked away and didn't do it, and they booed him, and that's what you needed to, it was what you needed to do. So, yeah, I mean, as far as this angle goes, you know, I thought, you know, that finish was tremendous.
We had two superstars matches. And by the way, when Michael Cole came out before the show, the man was hated, just hated. So the two matches were Primo with AJ against Darren Young, and it was a fine match. Primo's good. Darren Young, I think there was only one botch spot that the two of them did. Overall, it was a pretty decent match, and Darren Young got the win with his full Nelson twisting facebuster Delia Bob. So that was that. And then we had a Divas match with Alicia Fox against Melina, which it's funny because there were loud "you can't wrestle" chants, and it really was not quite that bad, but the people hated this match, and it was sloppy. Not horrible or anything like that, but a sloppy match, and Melina ended up getting the win and used a backslide into a bridge for the pin. And that was that. So, Raw opened up with Cena coming out by himself, and he did a promo saying that, you know, this is what I've got to do. He mentioned that he cannot go to SmackDown if he gets fired. Didn't explain why, but he can't.
Well, I think they had to say that.
Well, they have to say it, yes, but there was no...
Because that was the big thing last week where everyone's going, well, so get fired, go to SmackDown. You don't have to take this shit. So I think that he needed to go in there and say, like, no, if I'm fired, I can't go to SmackDown. They needed, you know, they need that line out there.
It would be nice if they had some sort of explanation for it, since guys do get fired and go to SmackDown, and so it would be nice to know why he would not be allowed to do that.
Maybe it's
the GM should have said something.
The GM probably should have said something last week. But you know, I think that the fact they recognized it, and they didn't, you know, I mean, there was no real right way for the GM to say that this week. So him just at least he threw that out there.
Yeah. And by the way, Cena and Orton were the two guys on the show that were over as big-time superstars. A lot of the guys were over as stars. There was nobody that got like a Jeff Jarrett reaction from the TNA pay-per-view last night. But Orton and Cena in particular, when they came out, everybody was on their feet. And even Daniel Bryan, there were a fair number of people that stood up because it was his hometown, but in general, I mean, those two guys were like a level above everybody else. Miz and Alex Riley came out, and Cena basically said that he wanted to be the team captain, or on the team for bragging rights. Miz said he was the team captain, and he said that Cena could be on the team if he wanted to, and Wade Barrett came out and said, no, I need Cena in my corner for my match for the title. And Cena tried to explain that he could do both, and Barrett said, I don't want you to do both. I want you to be in my corner and not on Team Raw. Teased that Miz might cash in Money in the Bank at the show. GM ended up announcing...
Yeah, that was actually pretty funny because Riley gave this big speech, and then Miz like looked at him and goes, well, so much for the element of surprise.
Yes.
I thought that was just... I mean, it was stupid, but it was kind of entertaining, too.
The best comedy WWE does is the understated comedy.
Yeah.
And this was a good example of that. So the GM then announced that they were going to do some matches tonight, a series of them, to determine who was going to be on Team Raw. And he also announced that Cena and Miz were going to have a match to determine who was going to be the team captain. Somehow, a brawl broke out. And Miz and Riley attacked Barrett, and Cena stood there for a bit watching Barrett get beaten on, and then finally he ran over and...
Well, Barrett started by headbutting Miz.
Okay, I missed that part.
And then Riley jumped him and they were beating him down, and then, yeah, then the hesitation. The way it was explained on TV was that Cena was doing nothing because Barrett didn't order him to do anything.
I see.
Then when Barrett told him he had to help, that's when he helped.
So now, I believe there was a point where Barrett was yelling at him afterwards. Was that because he didn't jump in fast enough?
Probably because he didn't jump in before Barrett had to instruct him to do it. He should have figured it out on his own.
I see.
But he...
Well, probably. Wade's right.
What?
Wade's right. Come on now.
Yeah.
We had R-Truth against Ted DiBiase, and I don't know what they showed on TV, but I'm pretty sure that DiBiase didn't get an entrance. And there was another match as well where somebody didn't get an entrance. Zack Ryder. And in both cases, the guy who did not get an entrance lost. So I presume that there were timing issues on the show. But when you're doing a qualifying match, an important qualifying match, to not give a guy an entrance is so goofy. And I realized...
Well, they had editing issues.
Yeah,
They had to rush a lot of things in the show because they did more matches than normal.
It's just like...
It was a seven-match show. They usually do five or six.
It's like, if there's an important match, the guys involved in the match, even in the qualifiers... But in both cases, the guy who didn't get an entrance lost.
I'm going to complain because Zack Ryder didn't get more of an entrance.
They should have all got an entrance in an important match.
Zack Ryder?
Yeah. Then Zack Ryder shouldn't have been in a qualifying match then if he's unimportant.
That was hilarious to just see that Santino Morella and Zack Ryder were in a qualifying match because... It kind of like tells you, God, Raw sucks. In fact, I saw the Jim Ross Twitter thing tonight, and on his Twitter he pretty much said, God, what a terrible Raw team we've got. I don't like their chances. That's what he said.
Yeah, well,
I mean, when you look at that team when it's over, it's like it's scary bad.
Now, isn't there one more man who's going to be added to the Raw team?
Well, it was supposed to be Mark Henry, and I don't know what... On TV, they said that he had a personal issue and wasn't there, and I don't know what it is. But I had heard Mark Henry on the team, and so I'm presuming that he would have also won a match on this show that ended up not happening. But maybe next... Obviously, next week that they'll add the final match, the final guy, I mean.
So anyway, in the R-Truth DiBiase match, they had a match. It was fine. Goldust showed up on the stage. DiBiase got rolled out. He did kick out, but then Truth hit his spinning flying forearm and got the pin. So R-Truth is on Team Raw, and he and Eve danced a lot afterwards.
Yeah. I don't know why he kicked out, because I thought that was a perfect finish, because it was like it heightened the feud. But by kicking out and then losing to the guy's move, it almost made it, like the Goldust interference didn't, it sort of directly was, but I don't know. It's like they gave you a near fall for a thrill, but for where they were going and what the story is, the near fall should have been the fall as opposed to just coming back and then doing your move.
By the way, I should note that WWE.com had a commercial for bragging rights on the website, and it actually was up there before the show had even started, and it listed Cena and the Big Show as the captains for Team Raw. So,
Cena was originally the captain before they had decided on the Nexus angle. That commercial was shot like a month ago.
I see.
You know, at least because I actually saw that commercial. I know the commercial. I saw it like 2 weeks ago somewhere. When it might have been like on cable or something when they screwed something up and promoted a pay-per-view ahead. So that's when I had thought that Cena and Show were going to be the captains.
I just bring it up because every now and then I read something from people that believe that you and I are full of shit when we claim that, you know, they change their mind all the time, like it's an excuse.
Well, I mean, we've had writers on. They'll tell you the story.
Yeah, if you look around, there's plenty of evidence everywhere, and this is a prime example of that. We had a John Morrison-Tyson Kidd match, also for a spot on Team Raw, and I enjoyed this match. They worked hard, and Kidd went for a sharpshooter. Morrison fought his way free and then hit the, I guess, one-man Spanish fly. I don't even know what the name of the move is, but he hit that for the pin.
Wasn't it the Paul Burchill move?
Yes.
I forgot the name that Paul Burchill used when he used it till his knee went bad.
I forget what that was.
Yeah, I used to think that move was really a really cool-looking finisher.
Yeah.
Now, originally, this was supposed to be a three-way with David Hart Smith, and I have no idea why it wasn't. And they, on television, even said that. They said this was supposed to be a three-way, but we haven't seen David Hart Smith all day. So I figured he was, for sure running in and jumping Tyson Kidd, after the match. But he actually, you didn't see him all day, did you?
I didn't see him, no.
Yeah, so I wonder what that was strange. They went on to, that's what they said on television.
Interesting. We had Michael McGillicuddy and Husky Harris backstage. They had a meeting with David Otunga, Heath Slater, and Justin Gabriel. I couldn't hear a lot of this, and
well, the gist is that we were all led to believe that David Otunga recruited those two guys as the big special plan, which I would think that they didn't they kind of like acknowledge that last week, like when Wade Barrett was mad at them for doing that. Well, anyway, if he was, now Wade Barrett is Wade Barrett actually came up with a plan, and they had no idea that there was this plan at all.
Santino and Zach Ryder, Team Raw match. Yes, these two men fought for a spot on Team Raw, and people loved Santino. He was actually very popular with this crowd, and wasn't really much of a match. And then, for the first time on Raw, Santino successfully used the Cobra for the pin.
He used it on Regal before.
On Raw?
Oh, yeah. I remember him using it on Regal.
Really? I don't remember this.
Yeah. He's used it.
I know he's used it on Superstars a million times and that sort of thing, but I did not.
I don't watch Superstars, and I've seen him beat Regal with it. So.
Well, there you go. He used the Cobra on Zach for the pin, and the place went nuts for Santino, although.
Guy, but him on that team.
Well, he can always be injured and replaced.
That's true.
Then they did a deal with Tamina where she came out and they cobra'd each other, basically. So,
well, she was supposed to jump in his arms, but he lost balance and it ended up being like a Fez press. And
yeah.
Then they started acting all weird.
Mm-hmm. Randy Orton and Justin Gabriel had a pretty good match until the finish. They worked hard. Gabriel eventually went up top, and he was going to do his 450. And who am I to critique Randy Orton's wrestling? But I was always told that when you roll out of the way, you roll towards the corner. And he decided to roll away from the corner. And Justin Gabriel, I guess, presumed he was going to roll towards the corner. So he jumped way out to overshoot him, but Randy rolled what I presume was the wrong way and got crushed by this 450. And Gabriel hits it, but then Gabriel sold like he'd missed, and Orton sold like he hadn't been hit. And then
Orton sold like he'd been hit, sort of,
but then he just stood up and RKO'd him for the pin. So,
yeah,
that didn't work out. So,
yeah, the thing that you missed also was they did a deal with Barrett where Barrett said he wanted someone to injure Orton. And so David Otunga jumps in and just goes, I'll do it. But if you really want a guy to injure him, he's got the 450.
And he was damn near right.
Yeah.
So that was weird. And Orton celebrated for a long time when the cameras were off, and he seemed totally fine, so I presume he didn't get hurt. But as soon as he got hit with that thing, he was selling his arm, and I thought, wow, that would sure suck to get an injury right about now. Sheamus and Daniel Bryan. Fans had been chanting for Daniel Bryan all night. And, of course, last week, Sheamus destroyed Daniel Bryan, and we got to talking about that. And there was speculation, well, maybe Bryan will beat him this week. And, well, he did not. But they had a competitive match. Bryan,
this really good match.
Yeah, Bryan
beat for a 5-minute TV match or whatever it was. Let me see how long the thing went.
Seemed longer than that.
Let me see. Sheamus, 5:17.
That's it? Wow.
Yeah, it was really good, though.
Yeah, Bryan beat the hell out of him early, and then Sheamus cut him off and went to work for a while. Bryan made his big comeback, hit a bunch of kicks, and finally the finish was Sheamus hitting a bicycle kick after Bryan had used a roll-up and got the pin there. So, again, there's your U.S. champion doing a clean job on TV. I think he's gotten one pinfall in a singles match since he's come to WWE. So
On television.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's had one TV win. Might have, you know.
Not how I'd book a champion, just personally.
Yeah.
At least it was competitive this week.
Well, it had to be. It's his hometown. I mean, and, again,
I knew he'd lose. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, at the minute the match started, I knew he was losing. But it was because of the slotting. You know, I mean, that's the problem with WWE is they slot guys, and you know that the guys in
well, they slot you, and they always kill you in your hometown.
Yeah, usually. They have occasionally made exceptions, but yeah, there's that mentality that the mentality is that so easy to get heat on a heel by embarrassing a babyface in his hometown, which to me was always, I don't know, I would have done it the other way. I always think that it's so cool when you go to a market and like one guy is like really over in the market, and you can and when you watch the TV you can see it, and they protect him in that market. I always thought that would make sense. That's sure how everybody else tries to book, you know what I mean?
Not even how everybody else tries to book, but I mean, just like, I don't know. I just remember back to UFC in Boston. Remember the UFC show in Boston?
Well, I mean, the UFC would always like the hometown guy to do well. But I mean, when it comes to, you know, booking, I mean, that's what Strikeforce did with Kung Lee for 15 years. You know, was they made sure that he always won. And that's why for 15 years the guy freaking drew money. You know, that's how you do it.
Yeah, but
he granted was given guys that he could beat, but you know, you can always stumble, and he did stumble once. But the thing is it's sure a hell of a lot harder to do that in MMA than in pro wrestling. In pro wrestling, it's
like, no, all I'm saying is like 2 months ago in Joe Lauzon's hometown. I mean, obviously it's real and that sort of thing, but he went out and he destroyed a man in his hometown,
Gabe Rudiger.
Yeah, and that was like.
There are
few reactions I have seen as big as that one right there.
Well, it was so explosive, you know, doing all the suplexes and everything, too.
Okay, so you can't do that in a fake match? It's even easier.
Oh, it's much easier. Like,
the point is, when you have a hometown guy that's popular, if you go out there and let him destroy someone and get a huge win, the people, I mean, to me, I would want to get a guy over huge as opposed to trying to get some cheap heat on a heel.
Yeah. No, to me, okay, unless there is a major reason not to. I would never beat Mysterio in Mexico. I would never beat Jerry Lawler in Memphis. Now I guess it doesn't matter. It's so many years. Punk in Chicago, you know what I mean? But in all those cases, they you know, Bryan Danielson in Seattle, quite frankly. I mean, and anyone, you know, like anyone who is associated with a hometown. I'm not saying Zack Ryder in Long Island, you know what I mean? But there's certain people who are very popular now. You know, William Regal in certain cities in England. You know, why beat him? You know, just let the people, you know, he goes out there, gets the big reaction, you know, on TV. You know, when Jericho was in Winnipeg, for example. And you just don't beat him in that city. You know, unless it's like for a world championship. But if you don't beat him for a while, and then you put him in a world championship match, it might actually draw a little extra people because it's the hometown guy going for the title and they've never seen him lose in his hometown. It's actually very easy booking, but they just, you know, their mentality is it's so easy to get heat on a heel by beating a hometown guy, so that's what they do.
They're idiots. At 7:15, people were chanting for Daniel Bryan. This was 15 minutes before Superstars even started. There were no spontaneous cheers for John Cena. There were no spontaneous cheers for Randy Orton. There were no there were people doing the Ric Flair woo, but other than that, I mean, it was Daniel Bryan. I mean, people were chanting his name all night long. You can't just let the guy go out and destroy Evan Bourne. You know what I mean? Or it gets probably a bad example.
You know what?
Two baby faces, but
he could have beaten Sheamus. Sheamus is over. You know what I'm saying? It's like Sheamus can lose.
Well, I have no faith in them doing that. I'm just saying you could
do that in the hometown. That's actually the way you do it.
Well, it is, but they're not going to do that.
Born, I mean, that's fine, but it really means nothing.
No, but at least he goes out there and wins, and the people are happy.
No, you know, I agree with you that they should have booked it for him to win. You know what else? And quite frankly, I'd rather have him on the Raw team anyway. You know, I mean, like him not being on the Raw team, it's kind of, you know, kind of sucks. It makes the U.S. champion kind of weak anyway, which is another issue. I mean, forget about
that's too late.
When you're in Seattle. I mean, it's like you really would want. I mean, don't you want that U.S. champion to mean something? Instead, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, he, you know, like I said, like, you know, he could beat Sheamus. It's no big deal. And, like, Sheamus is going to be dead with one loss. You know, and maybe Sheamus then goes and beats him next week in another city. You know, and you get more mileage out of it. It was a hell of a match, so.
Punk beat Evan Bourne with the GTS and then destroyed his shoulder, threw him into the barricades, threw him into the post, Anaconda Vice outside, took three men to tear him off. Evan Bourne heading out for shoulder surgery, out for 4 months. So there you go.
Yeah.
Natalia, promo. Talking.
The other thing I noticed with Evan Bourne when he came out is how small his upper body got, which I guess tells you, you know, I mean, when you have a shoulder injury, your upper body's going to get small, so
yeah,
You know, unlike so many of the guys who would have shoulder injuries and somehow not get small.
I always just, you know, I don't know. If I had a shoulder injury, it's just like, to me, do you really go out there and have the guy just beat the crap out of your shoulder for 5 minutes? I don't know. I realize it's fake and all, but he took some hard bumps into the barricade, and I don't know. Hopefully he's fine.
Hey, he figures he's getting 4 months off.
Well, he is getting 4 months off, that's true, but I would go out there and pretend my ankle was hurt.
You know what? I would, too.
That's just
me. And work the idea that you had an ankle injury, an ankle surgery, and except really having the shoulder surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's actually smarter. You're right.
Natalia did a promo and talked about how she was going to win the title from Laycool, and they came out and were annoying. This died live. Everyone just sat there and watched it, and you know, part of the reason was, I don't know, it was hard to hear some of what they said, this was a great example of bringing the crowd down before the next match.
Yeah, I thought when I watched it that this was the antithesis of the Ric Flair Mick Foley promo, in the sense that it was so rehearsed and so scripted, and when it was over, I had like absolutely no interest in seeing them wrestle each other
or appear on TV ever again.
Yeah. I was surprised they gave Natalia that kind of spotlight, but it was very evident that the only reason they did was to get, you know, Laycool over, which is fine. I mean, they've got a good act, but that really, that stuff that they did, I mean, it does make them heels and everything, and there is something to it, but when you got a back and forth like that that's so fake, I thought that was sort of a negative there.
Oh, I should add, by the way, that when CM Punk, by the way, they just announced out of the blue he'd been traded from SmackDown, and I don't know what they talked about in commentary, but...
Nothing.
Oh, great.
You know, other than we have him.
Sure. So, again, they could have put someone up for grabs at bragging rights, but this was just easier, I guess. So, anyway, the one good thing about the match that everyone actually laughed in a good way about it, and maybe they shouldn't have given the injury angle, but he had poor Evan in the Anaconda Vice, and he's in the midst of putting him out of action for 4 months, and he screams, "It's nothing personal!" And when they did the replay of that, everyone in my section broke into hysterics, so that was entertaining. We had Miz and John Cena in a no-DQ match to... determine who was going to be the captain at Bragging Rights. They announced, for no good reason, except that people were going to run in, that it was a no DQ match.
Well, that's the reason.
Yeah, there you go. So they did their match. The fans were super into this match, and maybe it was just the fact that they were dead for the girls thing, but this match came to the ring, and they were into the ring entrances, they were into all the spots, they were really into it in the last few minutes. And ended up with Riley running in. He got put in the STF. Harris and McGillicuddy ran in. McGillicuddy hit him with the neck breaker. Harris hit the big giant senton. Miz covered him, got the pin. And Miz advances to be the team captain. Team Raw at the Bragging Rights show. Big Show, of course, is the captain of the other team. And afterwards, they had the... greatest thing, where Wade Barrett was essentially begging Cena to hit him and get himself fired, and just buried Cena for being a coward, and you know you want to hit me. Wade's facials during this segment and just his overall demeanor, he was like the best heel. And Cena, of course, he got right forehead to forehead, and then he walked away and leaned on the ropes, and then he bristled and got back in his face again, and they kept going back and forth. And like I said, the fans were just totally into this segment, and this was just extremely well done live, and hopefully it came across as well on TV, because it really came across as like
it was
a big deal
on TV. Yeah,
yeah.
One thing on the show, and I don't know where this one's going, is they did a deal with R-Truth and Cena where R-Truth told him, he goes, you know, that a lot of the guys in the locker room are disappointed in you, and like, you know, what happens if they tell you to take one of us out? And then it's like, you know, you don't have to do this. You know, you can quit. You know, so it's like, I'm not sure exactly what that's supposed to mean, But he's going like, you know, we all thought of you as a stand-up guy. So it was, they were telling the story that the guys in the locker room, you know, were thinking less of Cena as opposed to, they know he was, they knew he was in a jam, but they didn't buy that he couldn't get himself out of it or that he had to do what he was doing. So I thought that was interesting because, you know, they didn't need to do it. And by doing it, it's almost like saying, well, maybe it isn't, you know, maybe he isn't locked in the situation. You know, and it was like, you know, we know that this is, you know, he goes, we know this is the dream job and you don't want to leave, but you can quit. So maybe he meant, you know, you can quit and go to SmackDown. I don't know. He just said you can quit.
Well, I would think that it was setting the seeds in case they decide to turn Cena heel. He's got a motivation. Everyone in the locker room turned against him in his time of need.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
So, yeah, this was fantastic. And then at the end, when Cena was sadly walking up the aisle and Barrett said, I have one more thing to tell you. You can't see me. And laughed at Cena.
That was great.
God, he was great.
That was great.
He was so awesome. So, oh, by the way, they also announced that next week, the GM announced that it was going to be McGillicuddy and Harris against Cena and Orton. And Barrett said if Cena lost, then he was going to officially induct Harris and McGillicuddy into Nexus. And you know what was amazing about this is oftentimes at TV shows, when an announcement is made for a match next week, the fans will boo because, of course, that means they're not getting the match tonight. But they announced this match before the live crowd, and this place went nuts. And
really?
They went crazy for that announcement. So, anyway, that was fascinating.
Maybe they thought they were getting a second Raw.
Well, they did get a dark match.
That is a dark match.
They did get a dark match here, and the dark match was, I think, one of the matches they've been doing in all the house shows. It was Randy Orton against Sheamus and Wade Barrett in a three-way. And the way they set it up was, they didn't announce this. What basically happened was Wade was in the ring, and they announced that your main event of the evening is a three-way for the title. So Wade stayed in the ring, and out came Sheamus, and then out came Orton, and they were all in the ring, and so everybody assumed that that was a three-way. But then they started to play John Cena's music, at which point Wade said, hold on, hold on, Cena, you are not in this match tonight, which we never even knew he was supposed to be anyway. I am replacing you, so just stay backstage. So Cena never came back out. They had a three-way. It was like the last dark match I saw for a show around here was a SmackDown taping when the dark match was Chris Jericho, I believe in his street clothes, against Edge. And they had like the easiest, safest, most basic match to the point where I thought, if these guys can wrestle this kind of match every night, they could probably work 800 dates a year and not suffer any injuries. It was the easiest match. That's essentially what they did here. There was almost nothing to it. Orton ended up pinning Sheamus with the RKO, so Wade did not take the fall and went about, I don't know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and everybody cheered the RKO, and then they all went home. So there you go. Let's talk a little bit about the other big show for this evening, which was the Impact tapings. And we talked a lot about Impact earlier, but looking at these taping results here, man, this looks like a bad show.
Actually, I wouldn't say that. I think some of the stuff looks good. Some of the stuff looks real bad.
Well, I guess we'll see which wins out. It opened up with Hogan and Eric coming out, and there were chants for Hogan to retire. He got some cheers. He got some boos. He blamed everything on Dixie, saying she lied, and now they're taking over. It doesn't appear that they have explained how they're taking over. So everybody assumed last week that Dixie had signed over the company to Eric.
They didn't indicate that yet, but I mean, we'll see on Thursday. You know, there's still a lot of features that, you know, that get added late.
Yeah,
that they don't show to the people.
So he's back to being Hollywood Hulk Hogan. The group is now called Team Hogan. Abyss came out. They put him over. Jarrett came out, and they put him over. He's upset that Dixie stole the company from him. Ric Flair and Fortune came out, and they teased that Fortune and Team Hogan would feud. But instead, Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan hugged.
Yeah.
So then Jeff Hardy came out, got a lot of cheers, also some boos, and claimed that he was the one who set up RVD for the Abyss attack. So that's going to be the big feud, is Jeff Hardy and RVD. I presume, which sometimes you should not do, but I presume that's going to be the big feud. Then Bischoff asked Sting and Nash to come out.
You know, the thing that I, that, you know, it, so much, you know, I mean, the one thing that, you know, just, again, and I think it's, you know, after all these years, you know, with their storylines not making any sense, you know, you would think that you would work to make them make sense. It's like if Jeff Hardy was going to turn, there are things that, like him and Abyss never should have been fighting during this whole buildup, you know, let alone Abyss, like, hitting him with a board and all those different angles. And it's like, so now he set him up, but wait a minute, what about all the other stuff that we saw? Is that fake?
Well, maybe they'll explain that, but don't hold your breath. So Nash came out and said that they offered for him to join, and Nash said he was sticking with TNA, which, unless they write him out of storylines tomorrow, I guess he's back. So we'll find out.
Maybe he got his raise.
Maybe he got his raise, which...
Maybe at the end of the day he didn't get his raise, but, you know, he was, you know, campaigning, you know, he was, you know, he never was going to leave, but he wanted to let them think that he was.
Yeah.
Someone called someone's bluff, but we don't know who called whose yet.
Madison Rayne told Tara she wasn't supposed to win the belt at Bound for Glory and said the only reason she had a job was because of her and said she needed to do the right thing. So Tara went out, laid down, Rayne covered her. Rayne is the new champion. Begs the question why he changed the title in the first place. Mickie James came out. She wants a title shot. So apparently they are doing Mickie James and Madison Rayne.
I guess so.
So I guess at least the...
So whatever. I mean, that lay down title thing, just so pathetic. That's, I mean, no, under any circumstance, just so pathetic.
I mean, does anyone not realize how badly that flopped in WCW?
Evidently no, and that's why we keep having the same failures. Boy, if, you know, you can't learn from obvious...
Monumental failures.
What?
Monumental failures.
Yeah, I know. You can't learn from... huge mistakes. I don't know. I mean, it's like, I guess you deserve what you get, but it's, you know, I mean, are they that stupid? Because I don't know.
Don't ask me that question.
It just like boggles my mind. You know, it's like, whatever. I'm sure there are things, well, it's the women's title, it doesn't matter. It's like, yeah, but why do it?
Why have a women's title if it doesn't matter? I love self-fulfilling prophecies in wrestling.
What does that mean? That they're going to get rid of the women's title?
No, I'm just saying that this idea of, well, the title's not going to get over, so let's just do this shit with it. Well, the U.S. champion doesn't matter. Let's beat him every week. Well, yeah, then he never will matter.
Yeah. And why even have a U.S. champion?
Exactly. Why have a women's title in TNA if you're just going to treat it like shit? They probably actually think they're doing something cool with it. Maybe that's the problem. Kurt Angle interview.
They probably think they're elevating it.
Oh, yeah. Kurt Angle talked about injuring his ribs again last night. And to be honest with you, I thought that he hurt his ribs when Kennedy gave him the rolling fireman's carry off of the middle rope and landed right on Angle's ribs. And then Jeff immediately gave him a senton to the same rib. So I fully believe that he injured his ribs last night. So Jarrett came out and noted that he had vowed to retire if he didn't win the title, and Angle basically said, I put this company on the map. If I retire, that's the final straw for TNA, which begs the question, why did you put this own stipulation on yourself then? So,
well, and also, why would you say that on TV?
Yeah, that's also a good point. So then he's upset that Jarrett married his ex-wife. Yes, that is now part of the storyline again. And
after you know, a year?
Yeah. Remember when Jeff Jarrett was growing out his beard and he was looking like he hadn't slept in days and he was having that cryptic interview with Mick Foley in like the coffee shop and nobody knew what they were talking about and it led to nothing?
Well, I mean, it did lead to Dixie that doing that one segment where he just goes, you know, like when we went to Kurt's house to bring him in the company, it wasn't supposed to mean you ended up with his wife. And so like they said it and it's like, okay, now we're going to do the feud, and then they never did the feud.
Well, now they are. Slow build.
Or are they? You know, I mean, isn't, you know, I guess in theory, you would think that when Kurt comes back, he'll feud with Jeff based on this angle.
Yeah.
But You can't count on that.
It says here, security attacked Angle and handcuffed him. Jarrett started attacking Angle. Taz hit the ring and went after Jarrett, but Jarrett backed off. Taz?
Taz. Taz dropped the headsets and ran to the ring, or walked to the ring. I'm sure he didn't run.
Oh.
But Taz didn't get involved in anything physical.
Well, thank God he hit the ring then.
Yeah.
He's the badass shooter that everyone's afraid of, but he's doing commentary and he'll never have a match.
Yeah. Maybe they'll book him in one of those match in a match where he doesn't do anything.
The Bret Hart spot?
The Bret Hart spot, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, where he just goes in there and chokes somebody out in like 2 seconds, like he did in that Lawler match.
Guess he could do that, yeah. Joe and Abyss. Joe beat him via DQ when Abyss bloodied him up with the ring bell. So Joe loses to Kevin Nash and then gets beaten so badly that they DQ Abyss. RVD hit the ring, challenged Hardy, and Bischoff announced RVD, Mr. Anderson, tonight. The winner getting the next shot at Jeff Hardy, which, by the way, ended up a no contest when Hardy beat up both men. So I guess I presume we will get a three-way, which should be a shock to no one. AJ and Kazarian and Beer Money beat the Pope in a four-on-one match. And finally, the Shore cut a promo. This was actually prior to the main event on Jersey Shore, and JWoww came out with Angelina and Velvet. And Cookie and JWoww went at it. They were pulled apart. So presumably she'll be getting $15,000 several times, leading to a horrendous pay-per-view match.
Maybe.
Again, learning nothing from the Jenna Maraska debacle.
Well, I mean, here's the thing that I think is the craziest is, why did they do that angle at that point in the show? I mean, shouldn't they have done that angle in the first hour? Because the second hour is the hour that goes against Jersey Shore.
Well, of course they should do it then.
I mean, I would think that not only should you do it in the first hour, but you should advertise you're doing it in the first hour because...
Dave, come on now. This is ridiculous. Are you trying to earn money here? What are we doing?
I'm trying to figure, like, what is the best chance to draw a quarter-hour rating with this pseudo-star? And, you know, the fact is that there are 5 to 6.5 million people who watch Jersey Shore on Thursday night from 10 to 11. And some of them may very well between 9 and 10, if you really advertise the hell out of it and say that she is on and she's going to be on in the first hour, may sample it. Probably not a lot because she really isn't the star of the show. I mean, I am not a Jersey Shore expert. I have seen the show. People who watch the show every week have told me that she's not that big of a deal on the show. And I know that everyone in the world knows who Snooki is and JWoww is, you know. I hear the name, but it's not like it, like, you know, whatever. But the point is that if you're bringing her in to try to pop a quarter hour, which maybe it will and maybe it won't, I don't know. It is the right night to do it, absolutely. And there's a right time to do it, which is the first hour. So why are you doing it in the second hour head-to-head with her own show when you pretty much guarantee that it ain't going to work?
Well, because they have no idea what they're doing.
Sounds so simple.
Really does. We've overshot our target here.
They're the ones who went 2 hours head-to-head with Raw when everyone told them that everyone in the world said 8 to 10. They went 9 to 11. And, you know, we saw the results of that.
We've overshot our target, but I want to do a couple of the questions here before we wrap it up. We'll do a lot more on Wednesday, everybody. We should have plenty of time that night. This person here says, I think the reason Hogan adds Flair as part of his faction is he doesn't want Rick and Fortune to overshadow what he and the other guys are doing. It shows Hogan's ego and insecurity. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think they're even thinking that deep. I think they're just thinking they wanted to reprise the Vince McMahon, Eric Bischoff thing, you know, not realizing that that was freaking stupid. So they figured that, remember that? That was like a real famous point in wrestling history when everyone thought that Eric Bischoff's going to come in here and feud with Vince, and then they hugged.
I hope they snuck.
Everyone thinks Ric Flair is going to go in there and, you know, with Hulk Hogan and Fortune's going to feud with these guys. So we'll hug.
I hope they snuck Flair into the building for this show. Just nobody would know he was there for the big hug. This person wants to know what the deal is with Desmond Wolfe. Where is he?
I think he's in Orlando. He's 60 days out. That's all I know, and no one will say more. You know, but it is him. It's not Bruce Magnus, because Bruce Magnus works some house shows. Last set of house shows, he worked underneath. So it's not him that's the reason that those guys are off TV. It's really too bad because their vignettes were great, and I was really looking forward to them against the Machine Guns. Not that Machine Guns and Generation Me, you know, as far as the match goes, you know, that they had a great pay-per-view match, and, you know, they had a good one the month before as well. But I don't know. I think that, you know, Desmond Wolfe and Magnus and, you know, they had something there with that team, and maybe, you know, they'll have something when they bring them back. So yeah, all I know is out 60 days, and it should be, you know, probably after the next pay-per-view, he should probably, you know, him and Magnus should be back on television, I'm thinking.
One more real quick. My question is in regards to Mario Milano. He's probably the biggest star in Australian pro wrestling history, with, I'd say, around 70% of people over the age of 25 knowing the name. My question is, did he receive any fame outside of Australia? Did either of you guys ever see him work or have any opinions on him?
Mario Milano was a star in the 60s before, you know, before, I mean, he worked some of the, you know, he worked different territories in the States before going to Australia, and then he became a pretty big star in Australia and, you know, ended up living there. But, I mean, he came back. I remember Victor Rivera and Mario Milano in the late 60s as a tag team in the WWWF, something like 69-70. And after that, I don't remember a lot of Mario Milano. I remember Mario Milano work in Japan, but he was mostly Australia. And yeah, I know he was really, he was, you know, real famous there. I mean, Barnett, who promoted there, would always tell me that the biggest draw, the biggest short-term draw they ever had over there was, because I had mentioned something about Mario Milano being, you know, your biggest star, because he's kind of like the, you know, because he stayed in the country and everything. I think he kind of became remembered as like the legend from the old days. And I said, like, you know, was Mario Milano your biggest draw? And he said, no. You know, I mean, said that, you know, for short-term, Bruno Sammartino was the biggest draw. And then, you know, for long term, as a babyface, he said that DiNucci, Arion, and then Milano in that order. So, but Milano, I think, ended up being, you know, because again, because he stayed in the country and he's still living there. And Milano just wrestled he wrestled a match, God, not that many months ago. You know, it was on one of the indie shows. You know, he's got to be in his 70s, I'm thinking. But, yeah, I mean, I remember him and, When he was with Rivera as a tag team, I remember that they were pretty, you know, they were both considered pretty good. So, I mean, he had a rep as a good wrestler.
That's going to do it for today, everybody. But as noted, we're going to be back Wednesday with a brand new show. We got a lot of big things coming up. New issue of Figure 4 is coming out tomorrow morning. And tomorrow morning also, Figure 4 Daily with Steve Corino. And for those of you that have not been watching a lot of ROH lately, Steve Corino is awesome. So he's going to be on the show tomorrow. Should be a fun time. Make sure you check out the Mick Foley interview if you've not already. We've had 4 straight days of Wrestling Observer Radio, so check all of those out. New Brian and Vinny show up tomorrow night as well. Also have shows this week with Todd Martin and Brian Stann, in fact, talking about Brian Stann's new book. So
really? Oh, you know, I still haven't read that book. I got it in my briefcase. I've been wanting to read that book for a long, long time. I've heard very good reviews on that book.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. It's quite the fascinating book. We'll talk about that later in the week as well. So
he's fighting Chris Lieben January 1st.
Yep, he's in training right now, in fact. So check it all out, everybody, and we'll be back again tomorrow morning.